This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Hello and welcome to Health and Living with me, Lim Soo Ann. Health workers are vital to the functioning of a healthcare system, and almost 70% of them are women when we look at the global health workforce. But as with any other workforce, any other industry, female health workers do face greater barriers to their equal participation in the health workforce and thus impacting the functioning of the healthcare system itself. So today I'm joined by Dr. Sagri Singh, Chief of Gender and Health at the United Nations University International Institute for Global Health, to discuss the impact of gender on the health workforce and how we can close that gap, especially when everyone is still talking about how we can achieve those sustainable development goals related to gender equality. Thank you so much for joining me today, Sagri.
Thank you, Sue Ann. It's great to be here.
So, you know, I want to start with the big picture first, right? If we first look at gender and health, you know, how is gender linked to health and why does it matter that we look at health through a gender lens?
Yeah, thank you, Sue Ann. That's a really good question. You know, when we think about health outcomes and health status, we automatically think about the biology and the physiology and how that impacts our vulnerability to certain diseases. But we don't really pay attention to equally important aspects of behaviors and the environment. And it's not enough to look just at biology, because behaviors and environment play a crucial role to how we might both be vulnerable or exposed to health issues, as well as how we access health services, recognize health symptoms, and some of the data that might exist. So let me give you an example. We know that gender norms and expectations particularly link issues around masculinity to smoking. And this encourages men to want to smoke more or to believe that smoking is giving them something more in terms of status. But we also know that smoking is a key factor in certain diseases like cancer, hypertension, and heart disease, which impact men and women quite significantly. So this is a way in which a gender norm or an expectation or a role really interacts with the biology to impact then increase health specific disease in one group, which is men. In other cases, we can look at, you know, the role of gender norms that might limit women's ability to access information and health services, which can then result in their being unable to recognize certain symptoms, unable to access health services in a timely manner, and it can result in higher death rates. And this could be seen in issues, say, like cancers, cervical cancer, and other factors like that, that particularly impact women. So here's another way in which a gender norms and roles in society interact with certain biologies that women face, and as a result of it, end up exacerbating a disease that could be addressed early on.
Now, we won't dive too much into the link between gender and health outcomes directly, because that's not the focus of our discussion today, but also really that's also something that has been discussed quite extensively, even if it's not something that's been acted on much, right? But if we look at then the impact of gender on the health workforce, is that something that you think we've paid enough attention to? Why is it important to look at gender and the health workforce when we look at the context of gender equality, of health equality?
Yeah, so you know, most of the data and evidence till very recently looks at the demand dimension of healthcare. And this is things such as barriers to service access experienced by women and the impact of health expenditure on limiting women's ability to access healthcare. We have issues around transportation in terms of accessing healthcare. But more recently, I would say in the last 10 years, we really have been exploring how gender actually plays a role in the delivery of health services. We really need to consider not only those receiving health services, but also those delivering these services. And as you rightly pointed out in the introduction, when you look at a health workforce that is 70% women, trying to reach a large population of women with their services, understanding how these health systems are either replicating gender inequalities that then inhibits their ability to provide the services in a timely manner with the type of quality of care that is required is incredibly important to consider. So we have to look at these issues around what is the evidence, what are some policies, how are health systems and institutions set up to really foster gender equitable healthcare, or in fact to reduce it or hinder it.
Hmm. If we first look at, I guess, in terms of gender norms, right, how much does that have an impact on women's participation in the health workforce?
Yeah, so there are a number of ways, Suan, that gender norms play a role in participation in the overall health workforce, but also the overall workforce, but also the health workforce. So we can start even before women go into work. The expectations and ideas of women's roles and what's appropriate for them and what careers work for them and how long they should work in those careers really impacts what young girls and young women actually end up pursuing in education themselves. So you'll see often there's a gender difference between women pursuing the arts and education and men pursuing more sort of tech and science oriented jobs. Now, these right away set women up to be in positions in jobs that are lower paying or might not have the more formal sector approach or private sector where you get more money and more job security. So another aspect of gender norms is this burden of household work that women disproportionately have to take care of. This really limits their ability to work full time. It often require, as the primary caregivers, they often require them to take time off. There are disruptions in their careers, or in sometimes they have to altogether leave their health work to manage family needs. They don't have support necessarily, even if they have partners, to be able to rely on them to do more work in the household. So this then impacts their performance. It impacts, obviously, their professional career goals. They're not able to advance because they're seen as absent or they're seen as not able to perform to the level that's required. Their remuneration or their salaries are then pegged to that performance. And then that impacts their economic and personal empowerment. Linked to that is also how women face discrimination in hiring practices. So all of these points that I flagged to you automatically come into play when people are hiring women for positions. And this is, again, very similar in the health workforce. These types of gender stereotypes result in women not being offered jobs that they can really excel in. And oftentimes, women themselves don't put themselves forward for those jobs because they feel like they might not be able to actually perform at the level is required. This is a type of internalization of a gender stereotype that many women face. Mm-hmm. Another aspect is the issue around safety and security. You know, this disproportionately impacts women's ability to really do their work well. There are cases where women are abused, they're harassed. Oftentimes in the health workforce, when women have to travel long distances, particularly in rural areas to deliver services, they don't have the support and security. And as a result, they're unable to deliver that service because they are unable to travel to the places that require the health services the most. So as a result, you can see these are really the different ways in which gender interacts with and impacts women's participation in the health workforce and in the broader workforce. And in fact, I wanted to just flag here an interesting statistic I came across, which was of a study that was done by the Women's Aid Organization. This was done fairly recently. It was only looking at 1,010 Malaysian women respondents between the ages of 24 and 55. but these were women who were active in the workforce prior to the survey. And what they noted is that 56% of them actually reported having experienced at least one form of discrimination, gender discrimination in the workplace. And this could have included questions or comments around marital status, on the plans around family, being passed over for promotion in favor of less qualified colleagues, often men, being asked to do tasks that their male colleagues were not required to do. So you see that this kind of discrimination that women experience in their daily lives is very much entrenched in health systems that are also a reflection of gender inequalities in society, and in fact replicate some of those gender inequalities that are in society in their ongoing work.
All right, let's go for a quick break now, Sagri, and continue our discussion when we come back and dive a bit more into the impact on the into what we're seeing, what you're seeing in the health system, and how that ultimately impacts the functioning of a health system and really the delivery of services and care to patients as well. I'm speaking today to Dr. Sagri Singh, Chief of Gender and Health at the United Nations University International Institute for Global Health, and we're about the impact of gender in the health workforce, and especially how women are often disproportionately affected when it comes to their participation in the workforce. Don't go anywhere. We'll be right back on Health and Living, BFM 89.9. Welcome back to Health and Living with me, Lim Soo Ann. On the show with me today is Dr. Sagri Singh, Chief of Gender and Health at the United Nations University International Institute for Global Health. And we are talking about the impact of gender in the health workforce, the impact of norms, stereotypes, and how a lot of all these ingrained barriers prevent women's full participation in the workforce, and how a lot of these are a reflection of the gender disparities that we see in the community as well. Now, as we both briefly mentioned earlier, Sagri, that you know almost 70% of women make up the health workforce, and from what I read, this was based on a study in 2019 that the WHO had conducted, analyzing over 104 countries. You know, at the superficial level, right, this seems like there's an overrepresentation of women in the health workforce. But what do you make of it? You know, what does it tell us about gender distribution within the health workforce?
Yeah, thanks, Swan. That's a really important point. You know, this statistic is well known and often cited. And I think what's key is that it really hides in the aggregate a number of issues and patterns that are actually detrimental to women's participation. So when you say it's 67%, or as the study points out, the 67% actually represents a segregation in health occupation by gender, in that oftentimes women are in nursing and midwifery cadres. That's what the study found in the 104 countries that it looked at. And they are often men who are physicians, dentists, pharmacists. So immediately you're starting to see that even though women are a large number, they actually are in not the highest professions in the workforce. A result of that also then is related to the gender pay gap that health workers might experience. And these differentials, the study points out, can be quite significant. But when you start to unpack it, there are a number of different ways in which this pay gap plays out. So obviously, there's a differential in occupations. Physicians get paid more than midwives, and therefore you see an immediate pay gap there. As I mentioned earlier, oftentimes women have to take time out of the workforce, need flexible time because of household responsibilities and other family needs. And as a result, what they say is that the work hours might vary, and women on aggregate seem to work less than men and therefore get paid less than men. And finally, there are other factors that are not related to work hours and occupation that in fact impact the pay grade and show the differential. So women get paid by paid less than men by about 11% due to many other factors that are related to their gender and not about these differential occupations or work hours. I think the other point to flag here is that this 11% also might reflect men's employment in the health workforce in the private sector, which again, and we know this from Malaysia, also pays much higher than, say, the public sector. So that's another consideration. But the most striking thing about this is that when you look at the 67% of women who make up the workforce, what it shows is also that there's a very small percentage of women that are actually in senior positions. And this is something that's really important that the report brings out a lot. So you look at 67% of women are actually in the workforce working at these levels of midwifery, nursing, community health workers, working at the front line at the community level. However, you don't see, when you break it down by cadre, you don't see senior positions reflecting 67%, which is why it's really important to, when you look at these data, to really unpack them like you're suggesting.
And senior positions, that would include leadership positions as well in healthcare systems, right?
Exactly. So healthcare managers, even at the level of supervisors, so women are not even represented well in the supervisory position. They're not represented in leadership positions. This really has an impact then on how women's issues, women, how work is then given out, whether discrimination is felt and experienced by women and by other marginalized groups that are not represented by the majority, which is often men of privileged opportunity.
What is contributing to that imbalance?
So again, some of the points that I had mentioned earlier contribute to some of these factors. So one factor, of course, is that when women and when girls are going to school, they are gender barriers and oftentimes norms and expectations that kind of move them to the arts and less to the sciences. Similarly, you see this kind of occupational segregation that happens when women go into medical professions. You find that they often end up going into nursing, midwifery, and even if they are participating as doctors or training as doctors, there's certain disciplines that they train in and not in others that men tend to occupy. So it's just these factors and the fact that women have this double, oftentimes triple burden of work, the unpaid work, the care economy work that they are doing, that really impinges on their ability to follow their careers to the best of their expectations, aspirations, abilities. And I think that, our work globally, and even, you see this in Malaysia, although things are changing, the workforce setup, employers, whether it's public or private sector, are not quite set up to facilitate women's participation in an equitable way. Our workforce and our employment laws and the way organizations and public sector and even the health system runs is very much on a male model of having, work is your primary occupation. You have other support in the household to support you so you can go to work and be the bread earner. You know, we see that maternity leave in many countries is not adequate for women to facilitate their continued participation or their ability to come back into the workforce. Oftentimes, there are more often than not, there are no breastfeeding facilities available or rooms available for women who might have delivered or care or childcare facilities to enable women, to support women, to facilitate their participation in the workforce. Similarly, we see for men too, it's not just for women, paternity leave is practically non-existent, or where it is existent, there's just a week or 10 days given to men. And even when it is given, there's so much of peer pressure not to mm-hmm. actually take it. It really impacts then the family and the community and the family and household ability and the ability of women in particular to support, to continue their work. And family-friendly policies is another area of work which is looking at how employers, public or private sector, and including the health sector, really needs to think about how we reimagine and re-envision our policies, our employment policies to, and our labor laws to enable women to participate in the workforce in a way that benefits them, their families, and the overall nations.
It's quite surprising, I think, when we sort of dive into it, right? Because the whole point of a healthcare system is to provide care for people, is to be empathetic, to be compassionate. And yet we don't see those same qualities being afforded to healthcare workers themselves. There seems to be a disconnect there in that, like, how can we do better to afford that same care and empathy to healthcare workers themselves, right? To treat them as human beings rather than, you know, cogs in a machine.
Yeah, I mean, I think that this is really important. And it's not just the health system, although we are talking about it. I think many institutions face this, you know, even education. I think it's really important. You know, what's ironic is that it is unfortunate that the health institution and the health system, which not only employs probably the largest number of women worldwide, but also delivers to the largest number of women in their work that they do, still treats women as invisible and as kind of not essential workers that have the rights and require the support that is needed. And we really need to, starting with our laws and policies, right through to the health system and how it is designed and functioned, to our education system, to communities, to facilitate and encourage girls to participate in jobs that are meaningful and give them the kind of support and economic and personal empowerment they need, as well as working with men and boys to facilitate that gender equity, is really critical. We talk about gender transformative policies and programs, and what that means is really looking at how we can change this inherent power imbalance and switch roles so that there is a more equitable distribution of jobs, of roles, of responsibilities, whether it's at the household level, at the health facility level, or at policies, to really ensure that women and girls can actually take part in the economic job market and contribute to the economy, but also to their own empowerment and well-being and that of their families. So this is something we really need to think about. And in fact, the experience of COVID has created the opportunity, has really brought these issues to the fore, mm-hmm. recognizing that, you know, this segregation of employment actually disproportionately impacted women. They are more in the hospitality, in the health sector. They were not able to go home and work from home. Mm-hmm. So as a result, they either lost their jobs or had to drop out of work because they had to deal with family or children at home, but also in many cases, they were on the front lines at the community level delivering the health services with very limited support and protective equipment, as we know. As a result, their exposure was much higher, which was problematic. So we really need to think about these issues and how we can, as a global community, really sort of address and rethink and reimagine the health system so that it is set up to serve both men and women and those of other genders in an equitable and meaningful way.
And when you brought up COVID, Sagri, you know, what came to mind as well was remembering certain reports that came out from many countries across the world, Malaysia included, about how pregnant healthcare workers were made, in some cases, had no choice but to still work at the COVID front lines, right? And it was, and while, you know, we applauded them for their dedication, that's quite concerning in that they still had to go to work. Like, we weren't providing them that support that they need so that they could prioritize themselves, their own safety as well. What are the implications then of all these disparities, these gaps, you know, not offering, I guess, the same standards to men and women? What impact does that have on our ability to retain and recruit healthcare workers, especially women? And as we know now, right, Malaysia, globally, a lot of healthcare systems are struggling to retain healthcare workers following all the stresses that were put on them during the pandemic.
Yeah, you know, I think this is really important. I think a first step is to really take a step back and actually have conversations with health workers, both female and male, to understand what have been the barriers to their participation, to their recruitment, what has been their experience as a result of COVID or delivering services in these types of conditions, or even pre-COVID, you know, where have they found the support, where is the support lacking, and how can the health system do better so that they can then provide the type of health service that the country is really looking for. I think, you know, it's interesting, we at UNUIIGH, we did a study in three countries doing a gender analysis of community health work in three countries in sub-Saharan Africa. And then we spoke to health workers in those countries to compare the policy versus the lived experience. And there was a huge disconnect. The lived experience of health workers, particularly female health workers, very much mirrored the inequalities that they faced on the day-to-day basis that was mirrored in their communities and societies. And the policies really, without taking this gender lens, inadvertently was actually replicating and reinforcing these inequalities in a way that were leading to poorer health outcomes, not only for the communities that they were women were serving, but also for themselves and their own health and well-being. So I think that really understanding this perspective of what it means, doing the type of gender analysis will help countries first reform their own policies and their investments. It will allow countries to really look at the health system as a critical system that needs to be really re-engaged in how you provide services by first making sure your service providers are equitably have the right support, and not just the commodities. They don't just need the contraceptive services or the stethoscopes or the supplies. They need that support in order for them to do the kind of quality of care that's required. And I think in Malaysia, there are a number of policies. There is definitely a recognition within the government of this important need. And certainly it's not just the health system, but also the broader labor force that Malaysian government is trying to enact many different policies with issues around childcare, paternity leave, maternity leave, ensuring private sector has equitable numbers of women in their senior positions, etc., that there isn't that much of a pay gap. So Malaysia recognizes these important disparities and are trying to, you know, enact the various policies that will facilitate a more equitable labor force, but also then equitable health workforce.
All right. Hold on to that thought for a bit and let's go for another quick break. I'm speaking to Dr. Sagri Singh, Chief of Gender and Health at the United Nations University International Institute for Global Health on the impact of gender on the health workforce. We'll be right back on Health and Living, BFM 89.9. Welcome back to Health and Living with me, Lim Su. And on the show with me today is Dr. Sagri Singh, Chief of Gender and Health at the United Nations University International Institute for Global Health. She's been joining me on the show today to discuss the gender gap that exists, the gender disparities that exist within the health workforce, how gender norms and the lack of support in the workplace have impacted women's participation in the health workforce, and how that in turn impacts our ability to retain and recruit healthcare workers as well. Now, Sagri, our Health Minister Kari Jamaluddin has said that he intends to table a health reform white paper later this year. Before the break, you spoke about, you know, the ways that we can tackle the issues that we're seeing now, right? But to dive into it a bit more, what are some feasible or practical steps that you'd like to see from us, right? Or really from the Health Ministry here in Malaysia to show that we're addressing gender disparities in the health workforce?
Yeah, so I think there are a couple of different things that could be done in looking at health reform. I think one thing for sure is looking at pay packages of health workers, male and female, and ensuring they are equitable, ensuring that there is enough parental leave, flexible arrangements, childcare provisions, these kind of soft issues that don't show up in the ringgit payment, but are critical to facilitate women's participation and engagement in the workforce. I'd like to see more thought and more sort of policies and investment going into developing professional career pathways for women from starting as nurses or midwives, if that's where they start, to building a career progression in more senior and supervisory roles. I think it will be very important to look at decision-making positions, both in the public and private sector. And, you know, one thing that's quite interesting to me that I read was that while the Malaysia gender gap is closing in some ways, when you look at the gender gap index, it's now the score the Malaysian government has said is about 71.4%. We see that, in fact, labor force participation and particularly political empowerment, that is, women's participation in parliament and ministerial positions, are quite low. So while you have women and girls doing really well on education and doing pretty well on their health, what we see is that these aspects of labor force participation, which is around roughly 55% in 2020, which is one of the lowest compared to other Southeast Asian countries, and the fact that the political empowerment is about 10% is quite telling. And so how do we ensure that even in ministries of health, we can have enough women representation and enough training of women and men in all levels of the health system to facilitate a more equitable workplace so that you don't have issues of violence, of bullying, you have supportive supervision, you have more training that can really help everybody do their work better.
And I think, you know, personally, I think a lot of us have seen, you know, many of us Malaysians have been watching multiple press conferences by the health ministry over the past 2 years. And I think you can very clearly tell that there is an overwhelming male presence in a lot of these press conferences. And it all goes back to having women at the table so that they can lend their voices, right? So that they can share their own personal experiences. And, you know, it's not policies that are implemented without women's input, because otherwise then it might not fit the needs of women within the health workforce. And on the note of reforms, I understand that data is also an important part in all of this, right? You know, how does data come into the solutions that we can implement to address gender disparities? Because without data, we won't know what to fix, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And so, Suan, data is incredibly critical. Gender data specifically within the health workforce, for particularly the reasons I've already mentioned. Understanding data around where are men and women within the health workforce, what is the type of work they're doing, how much time are they spending, what is the kind of pay they are receiving, what professional opportunities they might have. These are all critical points in terms of understanding the disparities that exist. And it's the first point of really understanding then how do we fix the problems. Data is lacking in almost every country on cadres. You know, what are the numbers of health workers by male and female? What are some of the barriers that they face in being able to deliver the kind of services that's required? What is the impact on their lives? Because this type of data is very useful to then inform policies and then inform the budgets and investments that are required in order to implement a policy that is transformative in its approach. That means it's transforming the roles and lives of women and men to be more equitable within the health workforce. So we need gender data, and we just don't need sex disaggregated data. We actually need gender data. And we need more research and evidence to actually show us how these gender transformative interventions or policies that are trying to change norms are actually impacting the lives of men and women in the workforce, in the health system in particular. So this is important.
Can I ask you to elaborate a little bit on that, right? Because you said gender data and not sex disaggregated data. How is that different?
Yes. What I'm saying is that sex disaggregated data is important, but in and of itself, it's not sufficient. So for instance, sex disaggregated data simply means the number of men and women in the workforce. Gender disaggregated data tries to unpack those numbers that we're seeing. What is behind the numbers? What are some of the barriers that men are facing? What are the barriers women are facing? What are the opportunities that might be available to them? So for instance, a simple example would be men and women are not accessing health services at the same level. So 90% of men in a community are going to the health center, 25% of women are not. That is sex disaggregated data. But gender data is actually then saying, why are women and not going to the health work to the health center at the rate of men? And that unpacks it. And it tells us that oftentimes the health centers are not open at the time that women are available. It tells us that sometimes health centers are far away from women's homes and the cost for transportation is not something women can afford, largely because they don't control the resources in their household, or their health is not given the priority that requires those resources. It could mean that mobility in the family is an issue, so women are not allowed to travel out on their own due to security and other reasons, and men in the family are unavailable at the time that the primary healthcare center, for instance, might be open. So it tells you all of these gendered issues that are then either hindering or enhancing the woman or the man's ability to access the health service. And then that allows us to then look at how do we adjust our interventions, our policies, our programs, our investments to overcome some of those barriers and then ensure that access is more equitable and health services are able to be accessed by men and women equally.
How might it impact the functioning of the healthcare system? How might it impact delivery of healthcare services if we don't address these gender gaps in the health workforce? Because people might think, well, does it matter at the end of the day, as long as I have a healthcare worker there to treat my illnesses to help me with my health?
I think it does matter if you think about the workforce issues. So, for instance, you have a large number of women in the workforce, say in Malaysia. If their needs are not met, first of all, you will see dropouts or absenteeism. That will impact both the efficiency of the health system, but also has implications for investment. That's investment in training of a very capable cadre of health workers that you have lost because you have not paid attention to their needs. So now you have to go back and train more people, and that has implications to the cost. Another factor is that when you have dropouts or when you have overburden of services on particular groups or subgroups or subcadres of health workers, particularly women, what happens is the quality of care, the ability to meet the needs of the patient, of the client, wherever it might be, whether it's in a hospital or in a rural primary healthcare center, that really starts to constrict. Mm-hmm. And as a result, the type of service that is being received and then the client's own perception of that service and then trust in the health system starts to wane. And this is not what you want. You want more people coming to the health system, coming to for healthcare sooner, earlier, so that you can address diseases before they progress to cost more money and to the detriment of the life or and the quality of life of the individual patient. So I think these kind of factors are really critical. Also, you know, being trained to recognize how women speak about their health. Mm-hmm. Women and men speak about their health conditions in very different ways. Mm-hmm. And women interact with women, female doctors or male doctors in very different ways. And so if you have only one sex or gender, men providing services overall, you're going to miss the ability to really provide services that are speaking to the direct needs of half the population in your country, which is women. So I think that all of, yes, you know, you can have a health system that doesn't provide any of these considerations, but in doing so, you will lose out in the long run because the health services are really not meeting the needs of half your population. And in fact, it is not meeting the needs of those that are the most marginalized groups that really need that support in healthcare in order to live their best life.
Hmm. And before we end, Sagri, you know, are you optimistic that, you know, things are moving in the right direction? Because I guess underpinning a lot of what we are talking about today are gender norms and stereotypes that are so ingrained in society, right? Are you optimistic that we can break those down?
I think so. I'm very optimistic that we can make a difference. I think the fact that COVID has really sort of put the good thing about COVID is that it put it front and center, and it's very clear that we can't achieve, you cannot achieve anything in society if you leave behind half of your population or half of your society. That's very clear. And in fact, not only can you not achieve it, but any gains you have made up till this point we have seen tremendous gains being lost because of this inequality and iniquity, particularly in gender, but in gender and other factors, such as when you link gender to income, to location, to religion, to age, etc., you start to see that there are tremendous deprivations that have happened that could have been avoided had we paid attention to some of these factors. But I am optimistic. I think that governments are committed. They just need to walk the talk. And I think the critical thing is that just like as people don't live their lives in silos, we have to understand that you can't fix the health of the people without fixing other parts of the society. So the education system needs to have a gender lens in order for health systems also should have a gender lens. Social protection needs to consider the gender angle. So we can't just do it by looking at the health system. All of these systems are interrelated, and it's incredibly important and for governments to take a look at it from that perspective to move forward. But I am optimistic. I feel governments have are committed. We just need to see the resources. And I am very excited about the young populations, the younger generations that are not afraid to stand up and claim their space, regardless of whether it's men or women or boys and girls or those identifying as other genders. So it's really exciting to see how they're claiming the space and really pushing governments to listen to them and make a more equitable world for them.
And on that note, thank you so much for joining me today, Sagri.
Thank you very much, Suan. Have a wonderful day.
I've been speaking to Dr. Sagri Singh, Chief of Gender and Health at the United Nations University International Institute for Global Health, or UNUIIGH as it's known, about the impact of gender in the health workforce. I'm Lim Suan, and this has been Health and Living, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.